this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norm with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. While coronavirus infections could go down over the next few months, we're still headed into flu season. Millions of Americans will be affected by the flu. But the good news is that we do have a safe and effective vaccine. But sadly, too many people go unvaccinated, especially African Americans. For more about flu vaccine, talk to your doctor or visit aawellnessproject.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the City Pop Central Show here on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I am yours truly, DJ Lee. And tonight I'm going to present to you some very relaxing yacht rock slash AOR music, just in season for summer. The first one will be Walk With Me by the Ritchie Family.
So you came back to where the whole thing started, and you walked around the neighborhood. Maybe see some old familiar faces, and wish that you could stay for good. There's a big old tree down at the corner where we used to talk the whole night long, making lots of plans about your golden future until your mama'd call you home.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh, that has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true, and of course it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. Whether, and that's, so you, there you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
Wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgians did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism. But the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything, commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, I was learning Spanish in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonized-colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you
right.
have the public school accent,
right.
meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants,
mm-hmm.
and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got le Parisien and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. That's not French,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African-American and the immigrant American community are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South,
yeah.
but it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel, where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting,
yeah.
though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. there's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquest of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumene, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian, because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the population for there.
Absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism, meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop. Now you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm. Both.
Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, yeah, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes. Vous en avez dans ma taille? You can go either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example, you can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English. That's not necessarily all in the same rap, but...
But potentially in the
potentially,
same.
Potentially.
Yes.
And often in multiples. And Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual spaces, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Right. Well, that's the whole question of register, of course,
yes.
You know, so that code switching between registers. My experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited, although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
And jock musicians apparently exist
jock
as
musicians
well.
As well, absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows,
yes.
Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point, too, about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking. So it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or et cetera. But what's cool, what's so interesting is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persine, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who's emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. If it's fed. And, of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, mm-hmm. which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
A pastiche of
Shakespeare.
Can
do a pastiche of Shakespeare and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Janie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby.
I just made that up.
I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed. Machines designed for plagiarizing, right? Yeah. They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even like Gabby et Jules and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening, but to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
Well, that's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How's that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. so, you know, I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles. But eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did because I've been binge-watching five seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
Yeah, that's right.
This is you. This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet?
Mm.
And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are. Okay. But just barely, right? I mean, you know, the fact is, we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. And now that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even in international, between spaces who don't actually speak English, and of course, speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet, they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a four-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today. Because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself, I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears because the waitress had insulted their French in French.
Mm-hmm.
Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. Mm-hmm. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted. You know, so that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from the University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English.
Mm-hmm.
The moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accents speak, then she could get in and continue living French-free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are in learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say, you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops
exactly,
different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important, so you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt, and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
That was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WRSCT Pittsburgh and WRSCT.org. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum. As we give you various news clips, we want to go back into the archives about 10 months ago. As we're talking about poverty in this country, here is Reverend Dr. William Barber on The Daily Show.
You, sir, are famously not white.
Well,
so why write white poverty?
Well, actually, I come from Caucasian, Black, and Tuscaroan descendant.
Oh, wow.
So, and my people are free people in Eastern North Carolina. There are a lot of those communities. And so in some ways, this book is me. And so to deny any part of my reality would be to deny myself. But here's the problem I'm concerned about. The way we measure poverty in this country is not only a lie, but I can say it on this show, it's a damn lie.
Sir, you can do more than that if you want.
Oh, okay.
We got plenty more room.
Got plenty room
for that.
But
yeah.
I only use the ones that are approved by the Bible. Okay?
You're reverent.
So we use the official poverty measure says that poverty, if you make above $13,000 a year, you're not poor.
If you make above
about $13,000 a year, you're not poor. You're kind of in the lower middle class.
When was the last time they adjusted?
Well, it's been since the 60s, really, in some ways. And so what happens with that is we marginalize poverty, and then we racialize it. Whenever we have a brief discussion about poverty, because we very seldom have it in the news, in political arenas, we put up a Black woman on welfare, which racializes and demeans Black people, but then it dismisses tens of millions of white poor people.
You write this 66 million?
66 million. Of the 135 million poor and low-wage people in this country, 60% of Black people are poor and low-wage. That's 26 million. 30% are white, but that's 66 million, 40 million more.
Right.
This book says we need to face all of our poor and recognize that we have something what Desmond, who's an author out of Princeton, calls poverty by America. Not the poverty in America, but the particular kind of poverty by America that's unnecessary and abolishable, because it makes no sense in the richest nation in the world. We have over 135 million poor and low-wage people, over 41% of our population, and over 50% of our children. And it's unnecessary. So white poverty says We're not playing the game anymore.
Let's not look at this through the prism of race. Let's look at it through class. And do you think that that division was a purposeful one?
I think so. And to expand race, you have to deal with race in America. But what you cannot allow someone to do for something this serious, where 295,000 people are dying a year from poverty and low wage.
How many?
295,000, 800 people a day.
Are dying.
Recent study from poverty.
From what they would consider poverty.
Like, poverty is the fourth leading cause of death in the country. Higher than respiratory disease. Higher than gun violence.
Well, I imagine it even impacts respiratory disease because if you're low wage and you're living in an area, exactly. Chances are the pollution and the toxins is probably higher where you live.
All of those things.
Right.
And so here we have something that's the fourth leading cause of death, 800 people a day. When 7 people died from vaping, it was a congressional hearing. It was presidential level. Right? Imagine right. If 800 politicians were dying a day.
Oh, I have.
Well, I can't do that. But my point is how everybody would be just up and out, or sure. 800 middle-class people, or 800
wealthy people. You're talking about 100,000 people. That's clearly right. Epidemic.
Right. You just talked about crime. That's a crime. That's right. A form of... especially when it's unnecessary. It does not have
and
to
entrenched.
Be.
And entrenched. It seems in a lot of communities, it's a cloud that never lifts.
Well, the thing about it is, John, it's in every community. See, that's the point we're making right. In the book. Whether it's Appalachia, where I met women in West Virginia who have to sell tacos on Tuesdays so they have a community fund to help women deal with their monthly issues, mm-hmm. or whether it's out in eastern Kentucky, where I met black and white coal miners who watched the mines be taken over by multinational companies that moved the union rights out of it, or whether it's in the Delta. It's everywhere. There's not a county in this country now where a person making $7.25, that's what the minimum wage is. Federal minimum wage is $7.25.
Right.
It's been like that for 14 years, John. It hasn't been raised for 14 years.
When they try and raise it to even 15, I mean, the fight is everywhere you go. There's a huge fight about trying to bring it to 15, and it's going to kill all the jobs.
Which is a lie. You know, three Nobel Peace Prize economists said it wouldn't kill jobs. In fact, it would put more money in the economy, and it would actually expand jobs. But here's the thing. We had 15 in a union proposed in 2020. 8 Democrats and every Republican stood against 55 million people. 55 million people who make, right. 52 million people who make less than a living wage of $15 an hour. Now, here's the thing. In 63, the March on Washington called for a raise of the minimum wage to $2, which indexed with inflation would be over 15 today.
Really?
Yeah.
And people forget the March on Washington in 63 was titled for
Jobs and Justice. It wasn't just about black civil rights.
Right.
It was about a broad, inclusive, just field democracy.
Right.
And so here we are in this reality, and people are hurting everywhere. There's not a county where you can work a minimum wage job and afford a basic 2-bedroom apartment. And waiters and waitresses...
On minimum wage. Not a county in the country. If you had a minimum wage job, there's not a county in this country where you could afford a 2-bedroom.
Not a federal, no, you couldn't.
And so this is the working poor. This isn't, you know, I think in the country there's a sense of it's an entitlement mentality.
Oh, yeah.
That's why there's a certain character flaw that keeps you there. These are people that are working.
Yeah, the entitlement is, and then the politicians that keep raising their wages and giving corporations tax breaks, but they won't help the working people. That's the entitlement. So we're talking about during COVID did not exacerbate poverty, it exposed it.
Right.
And what we did a study called the death during COVID, and we found that whether you were in a poor county in West Virginia or a poor county in the Delta, poor people died at a rate 3 to 5 times higher during COVID because of their poverty, not because the germ somehow discriminated, but we did.
Access to good health care.
Right. Well, 350,000 people died during COVID so far, one study said from the lack of health care. And if you don't face this, John, this is the point of the book. We have to face this. We have to look at it. We had 15 presidential debates in the last election. 40% of the adult population in poverty, 800 people dying a day. Not one debate was focused on it. We've not had an Oval Office discussion.
Why don't politicians value what is an incredibly
large population in many different, I'm sure, in swing states. So why don't they? Do poor people need better lobbyists? what is it that can be done to get a politician to listen? Yeah.
Well, I think that what we're saying now is we just had a study. I asked it to be done as a part of our movement, Waking the Sleeping Giant. And this is what we found out, that all of these numbers also tell us that poor and low-wage people now represent 30% of the electorate in the country.
30%.
Over 40% in states where the margin of victory was less than 3%. And in Texas, where it's less than 5%.
Wow.
So what we're saying to poor and low-wage people of every race is time to mobilize your vote. There's not a state where 20% of poor and low-wage voters that didn't vote, 57 million voted, 30 million didn't in the last election. But if 20% that didn't vote moved, they could change every election. And in most states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, it's less than 4%. So what we're doing is organizing a massive movement. In fact, on June 29th in Washington, D.C., there's going to be a massive poor people, low-wage workers assembly and moral march on D.C. and to the polls, saying that poor and low-wage people have to find themselves, white, black, brown, Asian, Native, and unite around attacking what we call five interlocking injustices: systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, the war economy, and the false modern act of religious nationalism.
Wow.
And John, you know, in our agenda, we're saying to Carlton, if you want these votes, bring them in at the top level. President Biden, bring a group of poor, low-wage folk and religious leaders to the White House.
Do people even listen to them? Do they even hear them? What has the response been when you reach out to our political class? What's the response been?
Well, because we've been lied to so much. You know, these at first they said, well, it's not that big. And then we proved that it's actually 135, 140 million. And then they don't expect that people are going to organize. You know, in a democracy, you have to engage in agitation, legislation, litigation, and voter participation. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying to poor and low-wage folks, let's use this power.
Right.
And so we're having this gathering before the conventions. We're going to touch 15 million poor and low-wage voters with the facts on where people stay in a nonpartisan, where they stand on the issues, and say, let's mobilize. And we, because that's the true swing vote. Celinda Lake, who's a major pollster, says the truest, most powerful, biggest swing vote right now is poor and low-wage people. And you know, John, folk often ask me, and you and I have talked about this, does our current society require that things be like this?
This was the real crux of the issue. Yeah.
And what this book says is, well, it's kind of like putting your hand in an electric socket that's connected. It requires that you get shocked because you put your finger there.
Right.
You don't have to do it, but if you keep doing things the way you are doing it, you're going to get shocked. So if you keep paying less than a living wage, if you keep denying people health care, if you keep giving greedy, wealthy folk $2 trillion tax cuts, but you won't even spend the money to fully fund public education, if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep having the level of poverty that we're having. And we don't have to do it. It is actually, I believe, criminal, a form of a policy violence to continue down the road.
And doesn't it weaken the system as a whole? You know, you could almost make the case that if the system is requiring a permanent entrenched underclass, then it makes itself ripe for instability. And I'm wondering, is there a way to change the mindset? Because the mindset in America is there is a moocher class.
Oh, sure.
These poor people are moochers, and they're taking resources from me. I work hard. Poor people get health care, they get food, they get whatever they need. I don't get it. Is there a way to change the mentality to view things not as entitlements, but investments?
Yeah.
And maybe to get labor not to be viewed as shareholders, that corporations have to view labor not as a means to an end, but as shareholders in that, and can that change the dynamic?
It can, but one of the first things that we believe we have to do when we talk about moral fusion organizing is, first of all, we should be examining every policy not by the color of a president's hair or how many porn stars he touched or what's the gait of his walk. does the policies you propose, do they line up with establishing justice? Do they line up with providing for the common defense and promoting the general welfare? Do they line up with our deepest moral religious values? Secondly, we must expose the level of death that's happening because this is not benign. Thirdly, we must make sure that folks see it all, that it's not one group of people. We've been lied to so much about this is an anomaly. This is just a small group. We cannot allow this to be marginalized anymore. And then we must have massive organization of poor and low-wage people of every place, every geographic and every race. And in doing that, we can put poverty and low wages at the center of our political discourse. And then, yes,
isn't that America first? Isn't that making America great again? Like, if you hollow out a country, how can you expect it to be strong? Wouldn't that be the absolute acme of strengthening a country from the bottom up as opposed to the top down?
You would think it would be, but if you've got people that are still living when they first wrote the Constitution and said even poor white men that didn't own jobs or didn't own land couldn't vote, if you have people with that kind of mentality,
right,
that this should be an exclusive democracy rather than an inclusive. But listen, the numbers tell us, though, there are more of us. The thing is, you can't be lazy in a democracy. You got to fight like heaven.
I mean,
and what we're trying to show people, the numbers are there.
Right.
Listen, Wisconsin, margin of victory, 20,000 vote, number of poor, low-wage voters didn't vote, over a million.
Didn't vote.
Michigan, 10,000 votes. The number of poor low-wage vote, a million. Pennsylvania, 40,000 votes determined the president. Number of poor low-wage vote, did about 2 million. North Carolina, 160,000, over a million. So it's not a big lift. And the number one reason, though, we did a study called Waking the Sleeping Giant, that poor low-wage people didn't vote, nobody talks to them. Politicians don't go in those communities.
Right.
I've gone in communities and people literally cry and say, Reverend Barber, nobody comes back here. And so what I say to them is, we're back here now, but let's mobilize to make sure they never forget you again, that they never forget you ever again.
Available now. Reverend Barber will be leading the Poor People's Campaign's March on Washington, June 29th.
Next up, we have Monique from the Don Lemon group. You know, Don is online now, just like Joy Reid is and several other people, because they're not on mainstream media. So we have Monique running it down for you.
Welcome, Lemonation. I'm Monique Presley, and you know what time it is. It's time for The Week with Monique, that one time during the week where I come to you with the one thing in the news or the one or two things in the news that I think out of the whole week of what's going on, you should be paying attention to. And man, am I excited, guys. I am excited to actually have good news that is The Week with Monique's pick. We got a black pope, y'all. Did y'all know that? Did y'all know that we have the first black pope? Okay, who am I talking about? If you've been under a rock, then you don't know. And I will tell you that Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost was selected at the conclave of all of the cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church around the world. He was elected to be the new pope after the loss of Pope Francis, and he has taken the name Pope Leo the 14th. That will be his new name, his pope name. And why am I saying that he's the first black pope? Is he the first black pope? I don't know, you decide. He is the first Augustinian pope. That's important. That's important, following in the tradition and legacy of Saint Augustine. And he is the second Roman pontiff after Pope Francis, who is from the Americas, but he is the very first to be from the United States of America. He is a Chicago native by way of parents in New Orleans, Louisiana. He was born to a father of French and Italian descent, Louise Marius Prevost, and a mother of Creole and Spanish descent, Mildred Bacquier Martinez. Y'all get where I'm going with this? He's got two brothers in the States, and I hope that they have security at this point because people are so mad now that they found out who our Pope is. Yes, he is of Creole descent, guys. And you know, here in the States, we follow that one drop rule. So I don't know any Black Catholic, especially, who's not claiming former Cardinal Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV, as their very own. He has a rich history, very well educated, seminary, PhD, legal, you name it. He is very well educated. He traveled up through the ranks in the Roman Catholic Church and church system, and he was given significant responsibility by his predecessor, Pope Francis. And the importance of him choosing the name Pope Leo. I don't know if you guys know this about the Catholic Church, but when the new Pope picks their name, when they leave their cardinal responsibilities and their given name, their birth name, and choose a name in the Pope lineage, the name that they choose says a lot about their thought process, their ideology, their intention. They're setting an intention, the road that they're going to follow as Pope. It means one thing if they choose John Paul. It means another thing if they choose Francis. It means another thing if they choose Benedict. And it means yet another thing if they choose Leo. I want to talk to you about the OG Pope Leo so that you can have an understanding. Pope Leo XIII, the OG Pope Leo, was known as the Roman Catholic Social Justice Pope. Social justice, is that something we need now more than ever? Absolutely. He was well known for his intellectualism. He was known for his attempts to define the position of the Catholic Church with regard to modern thinking. He had a very famous encyclical. That's a famous writing in the Catholic Church. It was Rerum Novarum, where he outlined the rights of workers to a fair wage, safe working condition, and was in favor and support of the formation of trade unions, while affirming the rights to property and free enterprise. He went in great detail on why there were all the good right reasons for that to happen. If you look up the Vatican, you can go and read the entire thing if you're interested and want to know more. And he became popularly known as the Social Pope and the Pope of the Workers, also having created the foundations for modern thinking and the social doctrines of the Catholic Church. So here comes our new Pope Leo, choosing to follow in the tradition of the social justice Pope. And let me tell you, he didn't just oops and uh-oh and decide to do that yesterday. That's the way that he has been conducting himself as a cardinal. That's the way that he conducted himself as a minor of the Augustinian order. And if you look, even when he places his bio places, like maybe on Twitter, if it's still up, I don't know if it's still up. It's hilarious to me if people haven't checked it out yet. Go check out Robert Prevost, Cardinal Robert Prevost Twitter feed. But anyway, the first thing that he says is that he is an Augustino. He is an Augustinian because of the importance of that in the church. And I want to just read, pop up a little bit if I can for you, of some of the interesting things that he said previously before he became the Pope. He had some interesting things to say by way of repost about our Vice President J.D. Vance and how he was incorrect and was reposting something from AmericaMagazine.org saying that Pope Francis' letter, J.D. Vance's Ordo Amoris, and what the gospel asks of all of us on immigration. You know, Pope Francis was a staunch critic of Vance's stand, and apparently this new pope is as well. He also reposted from ncronline.org an article that was explaining how J.D. Vance is wrong. Jesus doesn't ask us to rank our love for others. That was one of his recent reposts. But these two were back in February. His very last repost, very, very last one, was 6:47 p.m., April 14th, just a few weeks ago, 2025. He reposts Rocco Palmo's post that says, as Trump and Bukele use oval two emoji face for laughing, feds illicit deportation of a U.S. resident, once an undocked Salvadorian himself. Now, D.C. Oxen Avilio asks, do you not see the suffering? Is your conscience not disturbed? How can you stay quiet? That's the new Pope, y'all. And I just want to share one more, because if you look back about 5 years to a week that was critical and a turning point in this country for social justice, for civil rights, the week of the death of George Floyd. He was murdered on May 25th, 2020. And on May the 30th, the Pope, in his own words, said this, responding to someone else's tweet. Thank you. We need to hear more from leaders in the church to reject racism and seek justice. That's the cardinal in his own words. That's what he has to say about what it means to be in the church, to be a leader, and obviously standing against the statements by our current executive branch, President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. So I believe that this is good news. There are those who have said the only way we would ever end up with an American Pope would be if American leadership was on the decline, if politically America was not strong, because the Roman Catholic Church would not pick an American to lead it while we also had America leading the political landscape and leading the economic landscape. So they look at this as if it is confirmation of the decline of American preeminence around the world, because the Catholic Church was confident enough that they could pick the opposite of our current leadership and choose that opposite in order to lead the Roman Catholic Church. Again, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church is the Bishop of Rome, but is also the head of the Roman Catholic Church around the world, millions of people around the world, and is also a geopolitical leader and a force. What is said by the Pope matters, and I am looking forward to what this Pope is going to have to say. I want to explain a little bit, my second to the last thing, of what it means to be an Augustinian. St. Augustine refers to two distinct but significant figures, St. Augustine of Hippo, a renowned theologian and Bishop of Hippo, and St. Augustine of Canterbury, a key figure in the spread of Christianity. St. Augustine of Hippo, the one for whom the order is formed, was a highly influential Christian thinker who shaped Christian doctrine and practice. Born in Tagaste, North Africa, in 354 AD, he became a prominent theologian, writer, and preacher, significantly impacting Christian thought and shaping the medieval world. He was a prolific writer. He penned numerous sermons, letters, and treatises, and was a defender of Catholic doctrines. He also influenced the practice of biblical exegesis. He was one of the most influential Christian thinkers. After St. Paul, his work is still studied and valued. But it matters to me, and I couldn't finish the day without sharing why all of this matters in a personal manner to me. I was raised Roman Catholic. My parents are still devout Roman Catholics. We come from huge, big Catholic family out of Louisiana. And my godfather, Father John Nathan Lebov was a Roman Catholic priest. He's no longer with us. But if I had to think of, other than my parents, someone who walked the earth, who played a critical role in who I am today, there would be none that I would mention over Father John Lebov. He was a Roman Catholic priest in Mississippi. He was instrumental in the civil rights area. He worked with activists in Hattiesburg and Mount Bayou to promote voter registration among the communities. He had traveled the world. He was fluent in multiple languages. He was a gift in my life and an influence at just pivotal times from birth all the way until he transitioned. He was such an important person, and I have so many memories of great conversations, of graduations, of my Holy Communion, him being there, of my confirmation, of my graduation from college, and him taking the time to come. I remember the talks that we had and all of the things that he explained to me that shaped the way that I see the world. And I just can't imagine, for all of the history that he made as a Black Catholic priest who was preeminent around the world in the SVD order and as an Augustinian, because in fact, the same minor seminary that the new Pope Leo attended, St. Augustine's Seminary in Bay St. Louis, Missouri, was where my godfather attended several years prior, but the same place. So I feel like I've got a handle on this new Pope, and it's a good one. So it delights me to be able to devote and dedicate this particular week with Monique to my godfather, Father John Lebov. That's all I have for today. Thanks for joining. I look forward to coming to you again next week, 2 p.m. Eastern, with The Week with Monique. Please subscribe to my channel, the Monique Presley channel, where we do Make It Make Sense with Monique Presley, Monday through Friday, noon Eastern. And of course, keep coming right back here to the Don Lemon channel, Don Lemon Nation. We love you, Don. We're praying for you and lifting you up in the light.